Night, lows in the upper 50s, areas of dense fog in the morning, then mostly sunny, highs near 81. More news is next.
Now they're talking about Donbass, but Donbass right now, as you know, is 79% owned and controlled by Russia.
No let up in the ground war in eastern Ukraine, even as the White House tries to build momentum for diplomacy.
Today is Tuesday, August 19th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Ahead this hour, a Palestinian scholar lost his whole family in Israeli airstrikes on Gaza.
They all died. My mother, my sister, her children, my uncle, his wife.
Now he's at Yale University and fighting to stay in the U.S.
Also, a tree census is underway in New York City.
We'll meet some of the volunteers caught up in counting every tree in the Big Apple.
We counted about 3,700 trees. You know, it was never any kind of a contest. We were just enjoying doing it, so we kept going.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. A senior Hamas official says it's accepted a ceasefire proposal for Gaza. The move comes as Israel is gearing up for a major military offensive in the region. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Tel Aviv.
Hamas came under heavy pressure from Egypt and Qatar to accept a deal and said there would be rounds of negotiations if and when Israel accepts. The terms of the proposal are similar to one recently put forth by President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff. It included the redeployment of some Israeli troops and more humanitarian aid going into Gaza. Israel had previously agreed to it, but since then, the government has been preparing for an offensive into Gaza City. An anonymous person in Israel familiar with the negotiations told NPR the government received Hamas's response from mediators and is studying it and would respond. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services is stepping up its screening process. NPR's Jasmine Guards reports the agency has updated its policy manual to ramp up scrutiny of immigration benefit requests with new focus on anti-American and anti-Semitic activity.
Certain benefit requests require an immigration officer's discretion. Requests like adjustment of status and certain employment authorizations. Starting on Tuesday, the agency has said a primary focus will be reviewing evidence of an applicant's endorsement or espousal of views from anti-American or terrorist organizations, including those that promote anti-Semitic ideologies. Additionally, the agency has expanded its social media vetting. Benefits that are subject to officer's discretion include advance permission to enter as a non-immigrant, humanitarian parole, temporary protected status, and asylum. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
The Department of Agriculture says it will stop funding solar projects on U.S. farmland. The announcement from Secretary Brooke Rollins marks the Trump administration's latest effort to strip federal support from the country's renewable energy industry. NPR's Michael Copley reports.
Rollins wrote on the social media site X that ending Agriculture Department funding for solar projects will preserve land for the next generation of farmers. The USDA has been giving out grants to help pay for renewable energy and energy efficiency projects. The department said that subsidized solar projects have raised the cost of farmland. But a lot of farmers say leasing land to renewable energy companies is a critical source of income. And the USDA website says its grants boost energy independence and can help lower energy costs. The USDA announcement comes days after the Trump administration made it harder for companies building wind and solar projects to qualify for federal tax incentives. Michael Copley, NPR News.
At the close on Wall Street, the Dow was up 10 points, the Nasdaq down 314. This is NPR News. Air Canada is set to resume flights tonight after reaching an agreement with flight attendants who walked off the job last week. The union says the tentative deal guarantees that members will be paid for work performed while planes are on the ground, resolving one of the biggest sticking points in talks. The strike is affecting about 130,000 travelers a day at the peak of the summer travel season. Stargazers are in for a rare lunar event this weekend. NPR's Shondalise Duster previews the phenomenon known as the Black Moon.
When the visible side of the moon is not illuminated by the sun, we can't see the moon in the sky. That is called the new moon phase of the lunar cycle. Saturday's new moon is called a black moon because it is the third of four new moons to occur this season. And because our side of the moon will be in darkness this weekend, the black moon will be invisible. But planetary scientist Ashley Walker says the occurrence is still important.
This is not an astronomical term. However, I definitely think that this is something that folks could share their love and their passion for astronomy.
The next black moon is not set to take place until August 2027. Chandelise Duster, NPR News.
Leaders from across South America are meeting in Bogota, Colombia, to discuss the future of the Amazon rainforest. Indigenous groups are urging presidents to commit to stronger protections, calling the rainforest a lifeline for the planet. Delegations from eight Amazonian nations are attending the summit. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's 5:06. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. Partly cloudy tonight, lows in the upper 50s, areas of dense fog overnight and early tomorrow, then mostly sunny, highs near 81 with calm winds.
From NPR News, I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We heard lots of positive talk and optimistic predictions when President Trump hosted Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders yesterday at the White House. But will this translate into serious peace negotiations between Ukraine and Russia? Well, this morning, Trump gave this assessment on Fox and Friends.
I hope President Putin is going to be good. And if he's not, it's going to be a rough situation. And I hope President Zelensky will do what he has to do. He has to show some flexibility also.
To get the view on diplomacy and the state of the war from Ukraine, we are joined now by NPR's Greg Myrie. He is in the capital, Kyiv. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So it's been quite the past 4 days, starting with Trump hosting Vladimir Putin in Alaska, and then yesterday with President Zelensky and other European leaders at the White House. How are people there in Ukraine, where you are, responding to this flurry of diplomacy?
Yeah, I was at a government event yesterday. It included just about every senior Ukrainian figure aside from Zelensky. We're talking about the prime minister, the defense minister, the foreign minister. And really, to my surprise, they spoke about their plans for the next few months. It was really just business as usual. No discussion about Zelensky's impending visit to the White House. Huh. And among ordinary Ukrainians, they're definitely supportive of diplomatic efforts. They're exhausted by the war, but they think Putin wants to keep fighting and don't think he's serious about negotiations. So overall, I'd say Ukrainians at all levels are watching with great interest, but they don't seem to be raising their hopes.
Well, and speaking of being exhausted by the war, the war is very much rumbling on. Have you seen any shift? How would you describe Russia's military strategy right now?
Yeah, two main components. First, the nightly airstrikes. Russia fired 270 drones and 10 missiles last night. Russians targeted electricity and transportation sites in the east and center of the country. The mayor of Kremenchuk, a city that was hard hit, posted a photo of these thick black clouds over his city at sunrise. And he said, even as Zelensky was meeting with Trump, Putin was launching another major attack.
Well, and it's not just that city, right? Where else is Russia's military heading?
Right. There's no let up in the ground war in the east of the country, and in particular, a couple territories known collectively as the Donbas region. They will be critical in any negotiations, and Trump is starting to talk about this region. Here he is again from that Fox interview this morning.
A big chunk of territory is taken, and that territory has been taken. Now, they're talking about Donbass, but Donbass, right now, as you know, is 79% owned and controlled by Russia.
So Russia took a big part of the Donbas in the initial invasion in 2014 and more at the start of the 2022 invasion. As Trump noted, Russia has most of it, though not all of it. And Russia wants this entire region and would apparently demand that Ukraine give it all up in negotiations. Ukraine, not surprisingly, doesn't want to relinquish any territory, and it certainly doesn't plan to walk away from land it has fiercely defended and still holds, despite more than 3 years of these nonstop Russian attacks.
And can I just pause you for a second, Greg, to explain why Russia is so focused on this region in particular? Partly it's straight geography.
That's right. It's just across the border from Russia. There are lots of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers. They tend to have more ties to Russia and in some cases more sympathy with Russia. You know, many people in the Donbas have fled to other parts of Ukraine, but some civilians have stayed in place and are willing to live under Russian control. And it was an important industrial and mining area, though the regional economy has largely been shattered by the war.
Where is the heaviest fighting at this moment?
You know, it's probably around a city in the Donbas called Pokrovsk. And the battle there says a lot about the wider war. When I was in Ukraine last August, a major battle was underway for the city. The Russians advanced to within 10 miles of Pokrovsk, and it appeared they could take it at any time, but they didn't.
Just about 30 seconds left, but you said that was last year. Where does the fighting stand now?
Yeah, so there's still a very large Russian force. It's a few miles from the city. They have it surrounded on three sides. It could fall at any time. So we've seen this repeatedly in the war. Russia sends a large force, absorbs thousands or tens of thousands of casualties, and makes only incremental gains. They may take this city, but the cost has been astronomical, and the city lies in ruins.
NPR's Greg Myrie reporting there from Kyiv. Thanks, Greg.
Sure thing, Mary Louise.
When President Trump announced that the federal government would be taking control of Washington, D.C.'s police force in the name of public safety, he also suggested that other big cities could be next.
You look at Chicago, how bad it is. You look at Los Angeles, how bad it is. We have other cities that are very bad. New York has a problem. And then you have, of course, Baltimore and Oakland. We don't even mention that anymore. They're so far gone.
The people who call those places home might have been surprised at that threat of federal intervention. Let's hear from two of these cities, starting in Oakland, California, with KQED's Alex Hall.
It's true that Oakland has struggled with crime. Last year, Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom deployed California Highway Patrol officers to the city with the aim of cracking down on violent crime, auto theft, and other criminal activity. But recent police data show violent crime is down by about 28%, and vehicle theft in Oakland is down 45% compared to this time last year. So when Oakland officials heard President Trump's comments about the city, some were angry.
We're talking about having a president who had Oakland's name in his mouth about crime, who is a convicted felon, trying to talk about Oakland. I'm offended.
Oakland City Council member Carol Fife was one of multiple local officials who spoke before a crowded room at City Hall last week, driving home the message that Trump is wrong about Oakland. They pointed to investments the city and county have made in education and to address homelessness and public safety.
If you care about safety, Mr. Convicted Felon in the White House, if you care about law and order, you would know that the safest cities have the most resources.
Concerns over crime and criticism of local officials' responses to it contributed to the recalls last year of Oakland's last mayor and the county's district attorney.
Then of course we have more work to do, but we're doing the work.
The city's newly elected mayor, Barbara Lee, was in Congress during Trump's first term.
Let me just say, no one knows this president's playbook better than I do.
Lee said it's not a coincidence that the cities Trump mentioned have large populations of black and brown people.
These are cities, all of these cities, where the crime rates are going down. These are the cities that happen to be led by black mayors. What is this about? What is this about? His motives are fear-mongering and diversionary.
Lee says the city's legal team is analyzing the constitutionality of what she called Trump's threats, The mayor's office says Lee has been in contact with the mayors of other cities Trump mentioned, including the mayor of Chicago. They've discussed how they're preparing their cities for what might come next. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hall in Oakland, California.
And I'm Mariah Wolfel in Chicago, a city accustomed to being a rhetorical punching bag in national conversations around crime, and where freshman Democratic Mayor Brandon Johnson has honed his insults of President Trump.
I have never seen a president more off than Donald Trump, just off the rockers.
That's Johnson at a recent news conference where he said Trump's threats to send in the National Guard are unconstitutional and illegal.
He does not have the legal authority to do it. In fact, troops do not have policing power. These are soldiers. Soldiers. They don't go through the training that our police officers go through.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker argued, too, that Trump does not have the power to send in military force, especially to fight crime, against the will of the local government.
It's not surprising to me that he suggests violating the law. He's done it many times and been convicted of it 34 times. So I would just say he has absolutely no right.
Pritzker and Johnson have threatened legal action if Trump sends troops. Meanwhile, violent crime, particularly gun violence, is dropping across Chicago, with shootings down nearly 40% compared to the same time last year, according to recent police data.
This might actually be the first year in over a decade that Chicago ends the year with less than 500 homicides.
That's Kim Smith, a director at the University of Chicago's Crime Lab, which studies gun violence prevention strategies. Less than 500 homicides in a year, that does not call for a victory lap. But Smith says the notable drop in violent crime proves something that many people working to thwart violence in Chicago already know.
I know it's hard to believe, but Chicago is actually the birthplace of a lot of the strategies that we know work in preventing violence in communities.
In recent years, the city and the federal government has invested in targeted violence intervention, where often reformed gang members work the streets to prevent shootings. They go to hospitals to talk with victims and deter them from retaliating. They mentor and train young people, and they respond on a block-by-block basis to crime.
I would hope that we wouldn't lose sight of a lot of the great work that's happened in Chicago amidst this national conversation about safe communities.
The Justice Department recently slashed grant funding for violence intervention work in Chicago, leaving a $3.7 million hole. Many local leaders in Chicago are urging Washington to reinvest in proven solutions. For NPR News, I'm Mariah Wolfel in Chicago.
Do fish go to the spa? Yeah, we know. Okay, not exactly. But in some coral reefs, there is a type of fish that eats the parasites off of other fish. And now scientists have reason to believe that the services these cleaner fish provide, they might also feel good. The science of fish pleasure. That's on the next All Things Considered. You can come back here at this time tomorrow. Or if you have a smart speaker, try asking it to play NPR or your station by name. You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us Saturday, September 6th for Grand Rapids River Fest. I'm Jennifer Barr, and I am so excited for this year's lineup. Music starts at 3 o'clock with Alan Sparhawk, a prolific and versatile musician best known as the frontman of Low. His many side projects over the years reveal a musician unafraid to experiment. Then we'll hear Jeremy Albino. His songs are grounded in the gritty storytelling of classic country music propelled by the rhythms of old school R&B. And then Margot Price. She has something to say but nothing to prove, and in just a few solo albums she has cemented herself as a force in Americana music. We'll end our night with Courtney Barnett, one of Australia's most successful musical exports. She has played many festivals around the world, including Coachella, Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, and now Grand Rapids River Fest. Find tickets and more info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. See you September 6th. We are now less than 3 weeks away until Grand Rapids River Fest. We hope to see you there. Again, it's GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in to All Things Considered. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report. Local news from our region. There's also lots of local news stories and conversations at KAXC.org. Thanks to our listeners, we have raised over $160,000 during the crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KAXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. You can donate at kaxe.org. You can also share our work, those stories you find at kaxe.org. Share them with your friends. And thank you so much. There is more ahead from All Things Considered here on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from Chapter, offering comprehensive Medicare advice to Americans nationwide. To speak with a licensed Medicare advisor, dial #250 and say free help. That's #250 and say free help.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The war in Gaza has killed more than 61,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza health officials, and that's torn families apart. NPR's Dana Raff spoke to one Palestinian survivor who then came to the U.S. as a scholar at Yale. Unable to go home, he is seeking asylum, but the U.S. immigration crackdown puts him at risk of being detained. A warning, our report contains graphic descriptions of war.
In Gaza, before the war, Jasser Abu Musa was among the elite.
I was very privileged in Gaza, working for a diplomatic mission. My wife was very well educated. My father was a doctor. My mother was a lawyer. So we have been raised well. We have lived well.
Abu Musa, now 46, managed Swiss government aid projects. His wife was a poet, architect, and teacher. With Gaza under Hamas rule and the Israeli blockade tightening, they considered leaving, but decided to stay until their eldest son, Hamed, finished high school. And then 8 days after the war started with a Hamas attack in Israel, killing more than 1,200 people, an Israeli airstrike hit his house. Abu Musa had crossed the street to greet a neighbor.
I looked up. I saw that my apartment has vanished completely. I saw it on fire.
His wife, mother, and four children were in the building. Tearing through the rubble, rescue workers called for a body bag.
I recognized that a head with long hair. My son was having a ponytail, and he had the same characteristics of his mother's hair. So I did not know which one. I mean, I did not know if it was my son or my wife.
Two of his children were rushed into emergency. He was called to the morgue to identify the broken bodies of his wife and his eldest son, 18.
He was thrown 16 meters by the explosion, hit the wall of the neighbors, and he was down the stairs in the neighbors.
He says he was able to recognize his wife, Hiba, only by her lower teeth. She was 43, their 8-year-old son, Abdul Rahman, and Abu Musa's 7-year-old nephew, Yusuf, were also killed in the attack. There's a video of the scene in the hospital that day. As it happens, his brother, a radiologist, was on shift when the casualties were brought in. Realizing it's his family, he runs through the hospital, searching for his son, Yusuf. He and his family find the boy in the morgue. In February last year, Israeli forces stormed Nasser Hospital, where his brother Mohammed was working, imprisoning him along with other medical staff. Jasser Abu Musa says his brother, now 44, lost 30 pounds in his first 3 months in prison. He says he has not been charged. The Israeli military did not respond to an NPR request for comment about the arrests. Abu Musa managed to get to the United Arab Emirates with his two surviving children for medical treatment.
So we stayed like 40 days in the hospital. Abdullah, during these 40 days, has undergone like 3 surgeries.
And then he was offered a fellowship at Yale University as a peace fellow, arriving in January to focus on post-war reconstruction in Gaza. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas collapsed in March, making reconstruction even more distant. I'm speaking with him from near Boston, where he lives with his son Abdullah, who's now almost 18, and his daughter Sham, who is turning 14. Last month, he tried for hours to reach his mother in Gaza. 75 years old and in poor health, Hayama Madhoun had already been displaced 6 times. She did not want to evacuate again when Israel started bombing. At 3 a.m., he started getting condolence messages.
They all died. My mother, my sister, her children, my uncle, his wife. I did not know what to do, actually. I stayed crying for 4 hours.
He couldn't bring himself to tell his children right away. Abu Musa says he tries to protect them from what's happening.
I'm struggling to keep sane in light of my personal loss and in understanding what's happening in Gaza. I'm not able to understand it.
To be able to remain in the U.S. after the visa for his fellowship expired in June, Abu Musa applied for asylum. He moved to a quiet Boston suburb. Part of his asylum case is his public criticism of Hamas, the militant group running Gaza.
I was kidnapped in 2007 by Hamas because I was vocal against their coup in 2007. My wife was threatened in 2018.
Abu Musa is in the U.S. legally, but a crackdown by U.S. immigration agents, even on asylum seekers, has raised fears by many applicants that they could be caught up in raids. His asylum interview is at least a month away, but it could take much longer. Even here, after all he's been through, he still doesn't feel his remaining family is safe. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman.
New Yorkers are in the middle of their once-a-decade census for trees.
The goal is to keep tabs on the city's natural environment while counting and assessing every tree in the Big Apple.
Including the apple trees.
Of course. The last census counted more than 800,000 trees recorded by an army of volunteers. Volunteers like Wendy Reitmeyer and her husband, Tom Bettridge. They both took part in the last census and they're back at it this year.
I love trees and I was happy to be doing something that was outdoors and something that had a practical purpose that would be helpful to the city in taking care of trees.
All 5 boroughs in New York City are offering training sessions and volunteer opportunities for anyone who wants to participate.
Yeah, you identify the tree, you measure its circumference, then check the health of the tree. All that data is entered into an app developed for the census.
It's about a 3-minute process and one that Wendy and Tom have mastered. During the last census in 2015, they were among New York City's super counters.
We counted about 3,700 trees. You know, it was never any kind of a contest for us. We were just enjoying doing it, so we kept going.
Tree counting does change with the times. This year, the city's Parks Department will be using ground-based light detection and ranging scans attached to cars to automatically count the majority of trees.
Which leaves fewer trees for talliers like Wendy and Tom, but they say they are just happy to do their part for the city's environment.
There aren't as many trees to count on that basis.
There aren't, and I don't feel any need to run up the numbers. It just if we're both enjoying it, we'll keep doing it.
Yeah.
The result of this effort may mean a greener concrete jungle for New York residents.
The larger goal of the project is to increase the city's tree canopy from 22% to 30% by the time the next census rolls around a decade from now.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Partly cloudy overnight, chance for fog, lows in the upper 50s, and dense fog in the morning, then mostly sunny, highs near 81.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The following story contains details that may be upsetting to some listeners. A former teacher at two Iron Range schools faces three felony counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct for allegedly assaulting an adolescent female relative. Megan Buffington has the story.
43-year-old Ryan Ross Denzer Johnson of Embarrass was charged in St. Louis County on Monday. He's been a math teacher at Mesabi East since 2023 and resigned August 10th, according to the district. He also previously taught at Northeast Range and worked with robotics teams at both schools. According to court filings, Denzer Johnson sexually assaulted the girl at least three times over a 16-month period beginning in 2023. Law enforcement spoke with the victim on August 12th. Court filings say Denzer Johnson admitted to the crimes to law enforcement. Assistant St. Louis County Attorney Amber Peterson wrote in a filing that Denzer Johnson was aware for some time that he, quote, was prone to sexually assault minor females, but he still taught and worked in youth ministry and on a church advisory board. Each count carries a maximum sentence of 30 years, a $40,000 fine, or both. Denzer Johnson makes his next court appearance Monday. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals has reversed the felony conviction of a Colorado woman for her role in a 2021 protest of Enbridge's Line 3 in Aiken County. Chelsea Parkins explains the court's reasons for ordering a new trial.
The appeals court issued its ruling on Monday, nearly 2 years after a jury convicted Malene Villard of obstruction of justice. The charge was related to her role in a 2021 protest at Enbridge's Swatara pumping station. 56-year-old Villard was one of two people who attached themselves to a self-supporting bamboo structure in the driveway. The court opined that Villard failed to receive a fair trial because of, quote, a pattern of unusually serious misconduct by Garrett Sliva, former assistant Aiken County attorney. The appeals court remanded the case back to the district court for a new trial. The attorney general's office, which represented the state in the appeal, conceded to five of the more than 20 instances of misconduct alleged. This included several statements that could have led the jury to be prejudiced against Villard. The court noted she has a French accent and came from Boulder, Colorado. Villard came to support the efforts of indigenous people to protect water from the potential impacts of an oil pipeline. Attorney Claire Glenn is a trial lawyer who works with the Climate Defense Project. She defended Villard during the trial and the appeal.
I think this whole judicial system is supposed to be about accountability, but that often does not extend to prosecutors themselves.
The Aiken County Attorney's Office did not return a request for comment. This is the second Aiken County case against a Line 3 protester reversed by the State Appeals Court this year. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
Attorney General Keith Ellison is suing TikTok for violating Minnesota's consumer protection laws. Ellison filed the lawsuit Tuesday in Hennepin County District Court. A news release says he will prove that TikTok has prioritized profit over well-being and engaged in deceptive and unfair business practices. Ellison's office points to the social media company's, quote, addictive algorithm and other predatory features that it says are designed to take young users' time, attention, data, and money without their knowledge. Ellison also accuses TikTok of lying about the safety of the app, downplaying risks, and financially and sexually exploiting children with its illegal virtual currency. He alleges various harms because of these practices, including to youth mental and physical health and self-image. Ellison is asking the court to make the company change how it operates, in addition to seeking penalties and other monetary relief. International Falls is asking for community input as it plans the future of Smoky Bear Park. The park was home to the city's historic band shell, which burned in April 2024. The city says it is considering three options: recreating the band shell, building a new multi-use structure, or leaving the park as a green space. An open house in the city council chambers is set for Monday. The city is also accepting answers to a related questionnaire until September 2nd. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Tonight, the Kennedy Center here in Washington is set to welcome the Tony Award-winning revival of the musical Parade. The show tells the real-life story of a violent anti-Semitic incident in the South in 1915. The musical's production is arriving here in D.C. at a tense time. President Trump has executed a takeover of the Kennedy Center, and a prominent member of the Trump administration has promoted anti-Semitic theories about the subject of the show. NPR's Tom Dreisbach reports, and a warning that this story includes offensive language.
Parade dramatizes a true crime story that captivated the country in the early 1900s. Leo Frank was a Jewish northerner living in the southern city of Atlanta, where he managed a pencil factory. Frank was accused of murdering a 13-year-old girl, Mary Fagan, who worked in the factory. His trial was a spectacle, gripped by the threat of mob violence and warped by prejudice. Who's gonna stop the Jew from killing? Who's gonna swing that hammer? When Frank's case went to the jury,
guilty. Guilty.
He was sentenced guilty to death, but his sentence was commuted when doubts about his guilt grew. Then, after a prominent newspaper called Frank a Jewish hunter of Gentile girls and demanded vigilante justice, a group of men stormed the prison, kidnapped Frank. They took him to Mary Fagan's hometown, handcuffed him, tied a rope around his neck, and then a tree.
Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu.
The men who lynched Leo Frank on August 17, 1915, were never charged. The incident helped lead to a resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan, but also the creation of the Anti-Defamation League, the Jewish civil rights group. Today, most historians agree that Frank was clearly a victim of anti-Semitic bigotry and likely innocent. The state of Georgia formally pardoned him in the 1980s. The playwright behind Parade is named Alfred Urey. He grew up in Atlanta, born in the 1930s. His family is Jewish and actually knew the Franks.
The German Jewish community was very small. But when I was born, nobody talked about it at all. I had to go to the library to look it up when I was a kid. And it was very important to me to be able to tell the story.
The first production of Parade came out in the late 1990s and was critically acclaimed. In 2023, Urey said the show's revival reached even greater success.
Either fortunately or unfortunately, the zeitgeist was with us. The thing got very timely.
Part of that zeitgeist was the rise of anti-Semitic hate. A group of neo-Nazis showed up to protest the show, calling Frank a pedophile and Jewish terrorist.
Jewish terrorist, played on a black man, killing Mary Fagan.
The irony of that thing was these people hand-printed signs on sheets, and it looked just like the props in the show.
And it's not just neo-Nazis pushing these ideas about the Leo Frank case.
There's a picture of him right there. He looks evil to me.
Last year, the far-right influencer and conspiracy theorist Candace Owens ranted on several of her podcasts about the Frank case, claiming that Judaism and the state of Israel promote pedophilia.
We're talking about men like Leo Frank who rape little girls know that they can go, if they're Jewish, they can go to Israel and they'll be provided a safe haven.
Another right-wing influencer named Kingsley Wilson posted on social media just a few weeks after the neo-Nazi protest of the show. Quote, Leo Frank raped and murdered a 13-year-old girl. She added, the Anti-Defamation League is demonic. She later edited the post to call the ADL despicable rather than demonic. Now Kingsley Wilson is in the Trump administration. She's the press secretary for the Department of Defense.
Great point. And it's been a real focus of Secretary Hegseth, getting this woke ideology, this garbage out of our Department of Defense.
The American Jewish Committee called Wilson unfit for office and said that she was sharing, quote, anti-Semitic conspiracy theories lifted right out of the neo-Nazi playbook. At a tense Senate hearing, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth defended Wilson.
She does a fantastic job, and there's any suggestion that I or her or others are party to anti-Semitism is a mischaracterization attempting to win political points.
A Pentagon spokesman told NPR in a statement that Wilson has never promoted anti-Semitism and blamed the, quote, ADL and other left-wing groups for erroneously attacking her character. They did not respond to our question about whether Wilson stands by her posts about Leo Frank. They're still online. Orrin Siegel has tracked extremism for more than two decades at the ADL, and he's watched theories about the Leo Frank case move from fringe extremist message boards to popular podcasts and even a government official.
More than 100 years later, the anti-Semitic mob still exists. They just may not be on the streets of Georgia, but they may be on every social media channel that we all exist on. And so in some ways, it's the same hatred, but the reach is much, much farther.
And it's in this context that Parade is coming to the Kennedy Center, now under Trump's leadership.
We ended the woke political programming, and we're restoring the Kennedy Center as the premier venue for performing arts anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world.
In response to Trump's takeover, some artists canceled performances. Parade was already on the schedule. Alfred Urey said the production decided their show would go on.
As long as our cast wants to do it, we really want people to experience it. And we're happy to have it there. Politics aside, this is not about politics. It's about theater. It's about art form.
But in an era when the president threatens everyone from political rivals to major corporations and even Beyonce on social media, it seems the producers of Parade are careful with how they talk about the show. I asked Urey about Kingsley Wilson's posts about Leo Frank.
I have no comment about that.
Jason Robert Brown wrote Parade's music and lyrics. He declined an interview request, but sent me an email. He said the show explores the currents of hatred running underneath America, and that the racist incitements from more than a century ago continue to be repeated by people at the highest levels of our government. But he wrote that the Kennedy Center is America's stage, and you can't tell the story of America without the story of Leo Frank and Mary Fagan. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
Above the Arctic Circle in Sweden, a historic church is making big moves. The whole church in one piece.
Today, after one last blessing, the 113-year-old Kiruna Church began its journey. It's all part of a much larger project to move the entire city center because an iron ore mine has destabilized the land.
Now, moving an entire wooden building is a logistical feat to say the least. It took years of preparation. Engineers hoisted the church onto self-propelled modular transporters supported by big steel beams. They also needed to prepare the road.
Which they did by widening the road by almost 80 feet, also removing lampposts and traffic lights.
The church isn't actually going very far, just 5 kilometers or just over 3 miles away, but it's expected to move at a pace of less than a mile per hour. Swedish television is airing the entire road trip. So, if all goes well, the church will arrive at its new home sometime tomorrow.
You're listening to All Things Considered. A growing number of 20-somethings are getting a treatment known as baby Botox. It is designed to prevent wrinkles. It freezes the facial muscles to limit movement so they don't form lines. Health reporter Sarah Bowden looks at what is driving this cosmetic trend.
Filler in Pittsburgh is unlike any doctor's office I've ever been to. It smells like a fancy hotel, sounds like a nightclub, and specializes in non-invasive aesthetic procedures. Attorney Stephanie Moore comes here about every 4 months to get Dysport. Very similar to Botox, Dysport is another brand of injectable drug that temporarily paralyzes the muscle.
It's one of my favorite ways to treat myself.
Moore paid $462 for today's treatment. She started coming here 3 years ago when she was 27. Medical director Dr. Christian Boscat is administering the injections. He instructs Moore to scrunch her smooth face.
Wrinkle upwards. Perfect.
And then uses a green marker to dot where the creases and ridges appear. This is where he injects.
Her muscles in certain areas have died down from when I first met her.
Physicians I spoke to for the story said they've seen an uptick in 20-somethings and even some teens seeking it since the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Christy Hamilton is a facial plastic surgeon in Houston.
TikTok really picked up then. There was a lot more of this content on social media and probably a degree of boredom too.
Sociologist Dana Berkowitz wrote the book Botox Nation. She says because younger people live so much of their lives online, they're more aware of their appearances. And this is further driven by influencers on TikTok and Instagram.
They get free Botox or filler or microneedling or whatever if they're filming it and then they post it because it's advertising.
The Food and Drug Administration has not approved cosmetic injectables for minors. And Hamilton, the plastic surgeon, says there is no right age to start.
And sometimes we see people in their mid-20s that have a lot of wrinkles, and that's just life.
These drugs are derived from the same bacteria that causes botulism. Though, because it's administered in small doses, physicians say it doesn't pose a risk. But Miami-based plastic surgeon Dr. Paul Duran says Botox can cause too much muscle atrophy, which can make your face look hollow over time.
As we age, we lose volume in the face, so you don't want to compound that with causing muscle atrophy.
He says that hollow look is easy to avoid by not overdoing it. But there are people who end up looking frozen. Duran says if a patient is determined enough, they'll be able to find a clinician to give them more aggressive injections. That's partly because this is a lucrative area of medicine. Because insurance isn't reimbursed for it, people pay out of pocket. Also, sociologist Dana Berkowitz says once patients start getting Botox or a similar drug, they usually don't stop.
So once you get people in their 20s, you have a lifelong consumer.
Berkowitz is one of those lifelong consumers. She explains that when you stop getting injections, the effects eventually wear off, so people feel pressured to continue.
And Botox is not only addictive in that way, but it can also be a gateway drug into other cosmetic procedures.
Meaning those who start at 25 can spend thousands of dollars by their mid-30s. That's a lot of money that a young person could invest elsewhere. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. Thank you for listening to People Powered KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And at 7 o'clock, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. And now a message from the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988 with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. And support comes from the Bonner Eye Clinic, with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing. Welcoming Dr. Carlisle to their team, offering lid and cataract surgery, general eye exams, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Partly cloudy overnight, fog possible, lows in the upper 50s, and dense fog in the morning, then mostly sunny, highs near 81, and calm winds. For Thursday, mostly sunny, highs 80 to 85, slight chance for afternoon showers, especially in the Bemidji area. Gopher State One Call reminds you to call 811 before you break ground on any project, whether it's as small as a mailbox or as large as a house. This helps prevent accidents, power outages, and repairs. Call 811 48 hours in advance of any digging. The Edge Center Gallery in Big Fork presents Art on the Edge, their 19th annual juried exhibit during the month of August. We want to hear about what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. To news now of how a 50-year-old American restaurant chain has staged a remarkable comeback. The somewhat Tex-Mex restaurant is known for its fajitas, its burgers, and of course, its jingle.
I want my baby back. Chili's, baby back ribs.
Chili's has posted double-digit increases in sales in the past five quarters, and it's done it as its casual dining competitors are flailing to survive. Dan Coyce of Slate investigated what is driving the chain's turnaround. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
So I'll note you're not entirely neutral and objective here. You have a long history. You like Chili's, but you admit you had not set foot in one in decades. Why?
At some point, I just determined that there are better restaurants out there. I think it seemed like something that came with adulthood. You could go to a restaurant that wasn't a corporate chain and that didn't cook all their food from frozen and that didn't have a jingle.
Although it's already stuck in my head again.
Sure.
And has been more or less since the 1990s. Let's get into why. You interviewed Chili's CEO. This is a new CEO as of 3 years ago for the parent company of Chili's. What did he tell you was his vision for how to reinvent the company?
He brought in a whole team with him, and they all came together. They were the same team that recently re-engineered KFC and Old Spice. Both of those re-engineerings had a lot to do with tapping into people's sort of nostalgic love of that brand. And then while they were doing that, while they were trying to tap into this nostalgia, for example, having Boys to Men re-record the Baby Back Ribs jingle, they also were trying to institute a bunch of very strategic systems improvements that were designed to make it a better place to work. And a lot of these were like almost comically small bore techniques or transitions in the kitchen.
Yeah, tell me about the salt shakers.
Yeah, so for example, it used to take cooks in the French fry department, it used to take them 30 shakes to get the right amount of salt and seasoning on an order of fries because the holes in the top of the shaker were very, very small. And so they made the holes in the salt shaker bigger. So now it just takes 5 shakes, which, you know, of course, to me is like, duh. But also, no one had done that before, and it's saving everyone who makes fries 3 or 4 seconds every time they do it.
They also, setting aside the salt shaker holes, they've simplified. They've tried to streamline the whole menu. I will note, for example, I read with horror in your piece, you can no longer get chili at Chili's.
But when was the last time you ordered chili at Chili's?
I was a nachos girl.
That was the argument in favor of this change. Yeah, they've cut about 25% of the menu. And every time they do that, some customers complain, but they're sort of taking the gamble that the customer complaints will cause much less damage than the benefits given by streamlining the whole kitchen and making sure that all the food that actually does come out is both popular and good. They're sort of betting on the big mainstream American middle as their target audience.
One thing Chili's is not blazing the trail on: healthy options. Frying is king. There's very few low-cal offerings on the menu. How are they squaring that with a moment when it seems like everybody and their brother are taking Ozempic?
They're not squaring it at all. It should not be a surprise that like the viral moment that has helped kick off this Chili's revival had to do not with whatever, poached chicken breasts or something, but had to do with their mozzarella planks and these incredible TikTok videos of young people biting into a mozzarella plank and then doing a cheese pull, stretching the cheese, you know, the length of your arm. Clearly not a menu item designed around healthiness. Instead, it's a menu item designed around indulgence, almost decadence.
Dan Coyce, his piece in Slate is titled, actually, I'm going to let you say it or maybe sing it.
How America Got Its Baby Back, Baby Back, Baby Back.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks.
Until a few months ago, there were only two living Shakers left in the United States. Now, a third person has joined the celibate Christian sect founded in 1747. Maine Public's Maddie Smith met the new member of the Shaker community.
At the end of a beautiful summer day, friends of the Shakers weekend attendees settle in for a group sing-along of Shaker songs. A majority of women sit on the sister side of the chapel, and the men sit opposite, all holding lyrics to the songs, though few seem to need them.
Bright angels descend, I feel their presence.
59-year-old Sister April Baxter is unassuming in her colorful button-down and jeans, but has brought a palpable energy to the space. Baxter is the newest Shaker. She came to live at the village this spring and says the place was special from the first time she visited.
I didn't understand why, but I was very moved. I mean, I've been to lots of beautiful places in my life, lots of beautiful places, but something made me feel like I had to come back.
Before joining the Shakers, Baxter lived in an Episcopal convent for 4 years. But she says visiting the Sabbath Day Lake Shaker community felt like coming home.
Someone said to me, oh, that must have been a really hard decision for you to make. I'm like, no, it wasn't a decision. It's a calling.
87-year-old Sister June Carpenter and 68-year-old Brother Arnold Had were the last two Shakers before Baxter arrived. Had joined the community in 1978. He spends his days praying and working on the farm, but he says Shakerism can be boiled down to emulating the life of Christ through what he calls the three C's.
There's the confession of sin, which is the opening of the mind and the gateway to the church. There's a community of goods. Nobody owns everything, anything, but we all own everything. And celibacy, as Christ was celibate.
Celibacy as a core tenet has limited the community's ability to grow. But Had says people have been committed to supporting the Shakers for a long time. Lloyd Hunt has been a member of the official Friends of the Shakers organization since its founding in 1975. Hunt says the role of the Friends is to provide labor for farm projects, raise money, and to be ambassadors for the Shakers.
To spread the word that they're here and that they're a place that has meaning for me individually and that it might have meaning for you. So why don't you come and, you know, take a tour, come to meeting, do whatever else, and see if there's something that resonates for you here.
Hunt says there are over 1,000 members who believe in Shaker values but cannot fully commit to the life. Sister Baxter says that support has allowed the small community to thrive.
It's not just the three Shakers that are living here. It's everyone that's growing with us. It's the employees here. It's the volunteers. It's the visitors. That's such an important part of who we are and why this community survives.
Village Director Michael Graham first came to the Shaker Village in the 90s for a class project in his first year at a local college. He ended up spending his weekends for the next 4 years volunteering on the farm and attending Sunday meeting. Soon after graduating, Had offered him a job, and Graham has worked at the Shaker Village ever since.
So many people are drawn to this place to learn about the Shakers. And unexpectedly and surprisingly in the process, you end up learning so much about yourself. And that is a real equation for a long-term type of relationship.
Sister April Baxter still has time before she will be a full member of the Shaker community. But Graham says her understanding of what makes the place special leaves no doubt in his mind about her commitment. For NPR News, I'm Maddie Smith in New Gloucester, Maine.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. From Chapter, offering comprehensive Medicare advice to Americans nationwide. To speak with a licensed Medicare advisor, dial #250 and say free help. That's #250 and say free help. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. and from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9, and you can find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org.